delighted to welcome tonight, and thank you for doing it, Jamie Bartlett, who's written a fascinating new book, of which there are copies there for you, which couldn't be better timed, really, in terms of tech and the argument about tech and democracy and the extent of the power of big tech. How did the book come about?
Well, yeah, thanks everyone for coming, by the way, and thanks for having me. Are we really close to... I feel like we're really close to each other.
Okay, move on this way.
I guess I'd been seeing over the years, I mean, I wrote a book about the dark net in 2014, been looking at how social media is affecting politics for even longer than that, and I was a real optimist at the beginning. When I joined Demos in like 2007 or something, which is a lifetime ago, and no one was on Twitter or anything like that, I was very optimistic about the ways in which technology was going to be a brilliant sort of catalyst for democratic renewal.
Yeah.
And I was telling everyone how we're going to totally blow up the crappy old representative rubbish, this representative system, it doesn't work. We're going to bring in loads more direct democracy, we're going to engage with people. And over the years, like many of us, not just by virtue of getting older and getting more miserable about things, also just seeing the way that the sort of stories that kept coming out to do with various aspects of how monopolies seemed to be forming that we hadn't really expected, the way that people seemed to be behaving online with each other, the quality of political debate, what was happening to newspaper subscriptions, what was happening with Russian disinformation, what was happening with Cambridge Analytica. All these stories were kind of coming out one after another. And I kept seeing them in isolation for a while. And I sort of began to see it slightly differently, that they're probably all connected. They're all connected in a certain way. And my idea was that what connects them is a pretty simple idea. We have a system of democracy that was built in one time, a system of representative democracy built in one time and one set of technologies. And we have a suddenly completely different set of technologies which just don't follow the same rules and don't work in the same way. And a lot of the problems that we see at the moment are essentially those two things clashing together. Mm-hmm. So that was, I kind of tried to then pull all these different things together into that overarching story. And in terms of the timing, it was actually due to come out on the 31st of May. And next time publishers, if anyone's ever writing a book and a publisher tells you, well, you've got to get, you must meet this deadline by the 17th of January, otherwise we'll miss the 31st of May. It's bullshit. If they want to, they can push a button and pull everything forward by 6 weeks, which is what they did.
Yeah.
So we suddenly pulled it forward to like last week, at very short notice, because it felt so incredibly topical with the Cambridge Analytica story in particular. So I suppose I should thank Carol Cadwallader for that in a strange sort of way.
And that's Carol Cadwallader, who broke stories in The Observer on subject of Cambridge Analytica, but you were there ahead of those stories being broken. You were a long time before their revelations. Tell us a bit about Cambridge Analytica and your assessment of the story, this thing which is, in the mind of the Observer, is proof that Brexit was faked and all manner of other things. But how should we read that tale?
Yeah. So I was out in, I did a BBC series called The Secret of Silicon Valley in summer last year, where I interviewed Alexander Nix, Cambridge Analytica, and spent a lot of time looking into that.
He's the former CEO,
you're right, the former CEO of Cambridge Analytica,
yes.
The way I see it is this: there's been an awful lot written, not just by The Observer, but elsewhere as well, that, especially in relation to the Trump campaign, because there's no doubt that Cambridge Analytica worked on the Trump campaign. I mean, that's clear. Brexit's obviously still kind of up in the air. That there was some kind of magical psychological tool that they built, which was based on a particular profiling technique called psychographics, which, if you're familiar with, is the idea that you can, through standardized personality testing, you can work out where each person sits on a standard personality domain called Ocean. which is a long-standing psychological tool. It stands for openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, and a couple of others, neuroticism. And the idea is that you can work that out based on social media profiles that people have put up, the things they've liked, and then you can target adverts based on people's personality types. So you're a neurotic man, Ian, maybe, if I was to test you.
I don't know why you've come
to
that conclusion.
For example, so I target you with an advert about gun ownership, and if I play on those fears, it has a 20% or 30% higher click-through rate, and so it's a little bit more effective. And obviously spread across a million people, that's quite a lot. Cambridge Analytica always boasted that that was their secret sauce, but I don't think they certainly didn't use it on Brexit. I mean, there's no way. They probably didn't really use it during the Trump campaign either. They did use that during the Ted Cruz campaign, and Ted Cruz didn't win. So
they had worked for Cruz before they worked for Trump.
They worked for Cruz before they worked for Trump. When Cruz was knocked out, they moved over to Trump. What they did, so this stuff about psychological, psychographic testing and mind control is completely missing the point. And I think it's a lot of liberals who are just unwilling to accept that Trump could have won and are trying to find reasons as to why people might have voted for him. And it's rather convenient to say it was a mind tool that some evil, eaten, educated genius called Alexander Nix had inflicted on everybody. It's a lot simpler what they did, but I think it was very effective. They had something like 5,000 data points for each American that they built themselves through a combination of telephone surveys and commercially available data sets. There's a lot that you can buy about people perfectly legally. They then built profiles of millions of Americans based on the things they all cared about. They combined their data sets with the Republican Party data sets to work out who they voted for in the past and how fervent they were as supporters. And they shipped 13 staff members into Donald Trump's campaign team in San Antonio, Texas, where you had the RNC, Cambridge Analytica, and Facebook and Google sitting in the same room working together on this. And they essentially tried to identify people they thought were persuadable Trump voters, people who they thought were likely to possibly vote for Donald Trump. So you're never going to change the mind of a Clinton, hardcore Clinton fan with the micro-targeted advert. It's ludicrous. But maybe you can find the people that could be persuaded to go Trump. 6 weeks into the campaign, Cambridge Analytica tells Brad Parscale, who's running that, that we think the data shows there are enough persuadable Trump voters in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin that we can win those three states. Everyone else said it's never going to work, it's impossible, this is Clinton territory, this is the blue line. But he said the data suggests that we can, so they poured a huge amount of their resource into those three states, all of which they then won by less than one percentage point. And Facebook's own, most of the budget went on Facebook direct advertising using custom audiences and lookalike audiences, some of the tools that Facebook had. Facebook's own internal white paper, which was leaked a couple of weeks ago, said that the Trump campaign used Facebook advertising significantly more effective than Clinton did. They ran more versions of the ads. They tested more versions of the ads. They were better at using the targeting facilities that they offered. And so when I put those things together, I think, yeah, you know what? Cambridge Analytica probably were quite decisive in this election. But it's not because it's a magical psychological tool. It's just because they were doing better micro-targeting. But to me, that's a worry, because what is micro-targeting doing to democracy generally? If everyone is now a smaller and smaller and more precise target to be hit with a personalised message about the one thing that you care about, what does that say about the public commons, the kind of the public debates, how we all understand what each other's learning and hearing about politically, and what does it do to the political accountability if every single person gets a different message from the same politician? I mean, how do you hold people accountable in the same way? And it's really of note that Trump and Brexit, to me, are the two elections which people, significant numbers of people, just say it's illegitimate. The votes don't count. It was a fraud. It was cheating. It didn't. And so I guess the focus on Brexit and Agrica IQ and Cambridge Analytica's psychographic tooling, I think, is in danger of taking sight away from the bigger problem about what these techniques that all political parties are using is doing to the health of our elections.
Just on the Democrats, so Hillary Clinton's campaign was, as you say, was spending more money, but what went wrong in their HQ in Brooklyn? What was the, they did tons of this stuff, but they didn't. I mean, someone was telling me, explained to me the other day about how that final push where Hillary goes to, I think, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin in the final 3 days, was driven by the President Obama's team, who were running their own polling and essentially needed to plan ahead his movements for security detail, and said, why on earth are you not going to those states we think they're in play? To which Brooklyn said, don't worry, they're completely in the bag. What had Hillary's team done wrong in data terms?
I don't know. They didn't spend as much on direct Facebook advertising as
right.
I don't think they were as good as, frankly, I don't think their data scientists were as good as the ones that Cambridge Analytica sent there. So I don't think they were good at, they didn't have as comprehensive data points for each person. I also don't think they were good enough at using Facebook's, where they did spend money. They weren't running as many versions of the ads. Trump's team were running thousands upon thousands. I mean, they reckon it was over 5 million iterations of adverts. So they kept tweaking them slightly to see which ones were working best. They were doing A-B split testing. And then any time they found that one worked slightly better, they then upped the spend on that one. And I think the people inside Trump HQ were just more attuned to using those sorts of tools.
And you went to San Antonio.
I went to San Antonio.
And you, because I remember you finding the lady who said, yeah, and that's where Facebook's desks were.
Yeah, it was, you know what, because obviously when you're making TV...
It was great TV.
You've got to try and find a way of... It was an empty room, it'd all gone. So we had to... But we wanted to speak to her, and we thought it would be really nice to do it inside the building where they're all sat, so she could paint the picture for us. She was like, oh yeah, Facebook were there, and they were great, and we wouldn't have won it without them. They were so helpful. They gave us the white glove treatment because we were spending $70 million with them, so we're a very valued client, of course. And Brad Parscale claims that he actually insisted that Facebook send only Republicans to work on the Trump team, which is really, so they seconded staff in, as they do, I mean, because they're paying clients. And I've run directed targeted adverts through Facebook when I was polling the English Defence League through Facebook. Well, I did that in 2010. But I wasn't spending enough money to get anyone to come in and help me. Mm. But they obviously did. But it's very strange that they sort of, Parscale claims that they demanded that it was a Republican. He wanted people that were Republicans only working on the inside.
Was that about leaks, probably, or...?
I think it was just this. They had a very tight unit in there, and they wanted people that believed in the project. It was quite a messianic in there, from my understanding.
But all of that, all of those iterations of the adverts, for example, they were done by just really quite small team? Or were they contracting out some of it?
No, there's about 70 to 100 of them in that building in the end working on this. Designing the ads, running the ads, checking the ads, rerunning the ads. And they were doing a lot of ad. A lot of it was email adverts as well to raise money, and they were testing different donation colour buttons. They were testing which unflattering picture of Hillary Clinton performed best on Facebook ads, and then using that one again and again and again and again. So they were just, I think they were just better. They were just better at doing all this stuff. And it's an arms race, isn't it, elections? You know, one side gets an edge on the other, and then the other side learns something. And I think they were renegades, they were upstarts. I mean, I think part of the reason Brad Parscale decided to put so much into online was because he knew he'd have none of the support of the media pundits. A lot of the sort of Washington Beltway people weren't behind Trump. They didn't have much of a ground game. So I think he thought, our only hope here is to go hard on data more than anyone else has before. And I think that's what they did.
And to what extent was, I mean, Bannon comes very late to that story, doesn't he? Arrives late in the campaign.
But he was involved in Cambridge Analytica.
Sure.
He was on the board early on. So he was involved.
A friend of Mercer's.
So, but he wasn't, I don't think he was directly involved in
But he actually turns up in Trump Tower, I think, with about 10 weeks to go, and is obviously a positive voice saying that Cambridge Analytica know what they're talking about. But to what extent is it possible to know, did Trump understand it, or was Trump briefed on this, or did Trump just do his thing on the campaign trail and then they did their data thing with it independently of him?
Brad Parscale claims that Trump didn't trust it for a very long time and said, I think this is rubbish, none of this really works, TV is what really matters. And I think for a long time, Brad Parscale had to convince Trump that this would work.
Yeah.
He visited their campaign headquarters and spent time speaking to the team. Afterwards, however, he did credit Facebook and their efforts in San Antonio, Texas, with having helped him win the election. So after the event, yes. But during it, I think he remained always a skeptic. I don't think he really understood how a lot of it was working, but he didn't really need to.
Now, what about Cambridge Analytica and Brexit, which you referred to earlier? There's obviously not the same kind of connection because meetings were had with Aaron Banks, which is the non-official Leave campaign, and there have been a lot of stories in The Observer about this, but how seriously should we regard all of that?
I'm staying out of that one. I really don't know. I mean, some of it appears slightly conspiratorial. Sort of this person met with this person and they knew that person. And I really don't know. Honestly, I think we're going to have to wait to see what happens. I mean, you've got the Information Commissioner's Office is doing an investigation into this. I've got a feeling that there's more to it than meets the eye, not just on this story, but the general... It almost feels like we've suddenly set a bar about what we expect political parties to do with personal data, and we're very nervous about it and we don't like it. And I think almost every political party is looking at the bar, the kind of Evening Standard sniff test that we've suddenly set. And I think every political party is looking at it thinking, oh my God, we've been doing all this stuff for years and no one seems to have realised. So I don't think Cambridge Analytica is going to be the only company that will be involved in a kind of, you collected that data and you used that as a model to target people? Oh my God. I mean, I went and did a speech with the Institute for Practitioners of Advertising, so like the official body for advertisers. And I think they're all shell-shocked because they're like, when people find out what we've been doing for years, they're going to go crazy. Something about
it. This is not an aberration. This is the model.
This is the model, and this, I think a lot of people for a very long time felt this was completely normal, and it felt normal, and no one seemed to care about it. But Trump wins and uses some of these techniques, and everyone loses it. And so.
And Obama does it, and he's a genius. He's building community.
Yeah, that's obviously very notable. The difference in how it was reported in 2012 to 2016, but ad tech, as it's known, has got a lot more sophisticated since 2012. So it really does, it can do an awful lot more now than it could back then. But the general principle's the same and no one seemed to care back then. But so it feels like we've set a much higher bar now and we're gonna look to historical cases of the last couple of years, applying our new standard of, you know, what we expect our data to be used. And I think some people might be quite surprised about what comes out in the next few weeks. But as for Brexit and Cambridge Analytica, I just don't want it to, I worry that it takes, some people are going to try to use it to overturn the result and say it's illegitimate, and I think that's quite a mistake.
Mm. On the basis that if the vote is seen as illegitimate, then there has to be another referendum. I keep suggesting on reaction, I keep suggesting we do best of three. Or maybe make it like the Olympics, do it every 4 years. but maybe that's not a good idea.
One final thing I'll say about this is that the question of spending limits and whether money was funneled through one company to another company, IQ or whatever, is a different issue to the use of psychographics or other types of micro-targeting, but they seem to have been put together as part of the same story. And it's, to me, it's not the same issue. One, you could say, is a fairly straightforward story about funding levels. The other is about the use of personal information for targeting, and which data, what sort of data was used and in what way. But and I think blurring those two things together is a little bit unhelpful.
So you mentioned about stuff that's coming out in the next few weeks. What most consumers are experiencing at the moment is a blizzard of emails from companies, and many of them we've forgotten about.
GDPR.
Well, you forget about your sat-nav, which you clicked a button, you know, 3-4 years ago, and it now sends you an email, and for the first time you actually read what they've been doing with the information, which of course is by definition tracking your movement when you're in the car, and you match that against brand after brand after brand. Facebook is being almost the canniest of it, isn't it? Just by saying we're updating our terms and conditions, which makes it sound like a small technical matter until you actually get into it. But lots of consumers are being confronted with this now. Will that change their attitude? Because it has always surprised me that consumers are not more worried about this. People say, well...
Well, they are worried. Surveys show consistently people are worried. They just don't do anything about it.
Yeah.
I mean, they say, like, oh, I'm really worried about my privacy. I'm really worried about my data. And they do zero diddly squat to change any of it. So there's been this long understood sort of dilemma for companies where they know there's public concern about it, but they also know that they can carry on doing what they're doing and nothing will change. So GDPR, I think, is a bit of a turning point. And I don't want to go on and on about GDPR because everyone that worked in any of this is so sick of it already. And I think there's going to be loads of legal cases about companies and misuse of data. I think that there's going to be a series of exemplary cases from the European Commission about GDPR when companies haven't. And I'm sure some companies will create these complex chains of data ownership. So they're still doing the same thing, but technically this other company's the data controller, not us, they're just sharing. And it's going to be a bit of a mess. But given where we're going with data, given how much more data we're all creating and sharing, so the Internet of Things revolution, where there's going to be billions more data points in the next few years being created, and everything we own and buy and will be chipped and collecting data, I think it's quite a good thing to make it a little bit harder for companies to use all of this information. It's not going to stop the juggernaut, but it might slow it down a little bit.
Does it shift the argument towards where possibly it needs to get to, the sense that people start to feel that it is their data, that there's a question of ownership, or are we not there yet?
Well, we'll see, because people talk about it's my data, I should be paid by Facebook, because why are they making all the money, it's my data. And it sort of is, but it's also Facebook's amazing algorithms that make your crap data worth something. So it's kind of hard to work out where the value really is created in the modern data economy. Not as simple as some people say. Like, it's not just you and you producing data that's the value. It's how you turn that into something useful for advertisers. But I suppose the question at the moment for a lot of people is there this sort of awakening that we're suddenly aware of all of this and we realise that the things that we're doing online really matter? And that's one of the things I recommend in the book, because I come up with these ideas to try and save democracy and say, oh, we do these things, will really help us rescue democracy. And one of them is just about people being conscious of the things that they're clicking and sharing. Like, actually, don't read all the terms and conditions. It'll take you 1 month out of every year to do it. But be conscious of maybe which search engines are you using? There are other alternatives. Do you want to try and use some of those? If you're not happy with Google, don't just moan about it. Try and use the other ones, because they'll only get better if you use them. That's how it works. Up your privacy settings, turn on the ad blockers, use anonymous web browsers. I mean, there are things that everybody can do that just gives you a little bit more control over the information that you're putting out there. And I think that's quite important, because we may sit around and whinge about all this, and we do, but we are building these. I mean, moaning about Uber, and then I'll be out there ordering an Uber in 5 minutes, and I'll be saying how terrorism, like Amazon, oh my God, and I'll be ordering books on Amazon. Well, if we want to change any of that, then we've actually got to do something ourselves.
Yeah, it's actually very difficult to convince, I mean, even as a small business like Reaction, you spot this in brand terms. We thought, well, we do offers for annual membership, rather than doing the most obvious thing, which is an Amazon voucher, let's try the book voucher card, which is actually a terrific thing, supports independent bookshops, but still doesn't have the same allure as people just instantly say, 10 or 20 quid off Amazon, somehow connects with them.
Yeah, so this is all very convenient, and it's good for each of us individually. Like, I benefit immeasurably from Amazon and Uber and Google and Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and all the rest of them. But at some point you start to wonder, is this helping the long-term health of our democracies? And am I kind of complicit somehow in building an ecosystem and a set of monopolies that are actually undermining the very basis of our democracy? Mm. And I hope, weirdly, that this Cambridge Analytica stuff, even though it's only tangentially related in a way, is a bit of a turning point. But then again, I did predict, following the Edward Snowden revelations, that everyone was about to download anonymous web browsers and encrypted messaging apps, and this was the end, and, you know, it's going to be a game changer. And to be perfectly honest, not that much happened. I mean, there was a bit of a surge of default encrypted messaging apps that came as a result of Edward Snowden, but it was less than I thought. So I guess it's too early to know whether there's going to be a real change. Is GDPR causing you a pain? Because you presumably have got to start.
It is. There's an email going out soon. But yes, everyone should do it. But there are various sites. If you run a business, there are various sites you just tune into which tell you what to send to people. It's actually quite a good exercise. But personally, it's just brands I'd completely forgotten about.
Yeah.
That have just somehow embedded themselves in your life and now contacting you properly and starting to pay attention in a way that maybe we should have done.
Well, that's good. Yeah, that's good.
But it is. But you mentioned the rise of the tech giants, a subject that absolutely fascinates me. They're relatively new, aren't they? I mean, is that part of the reason that we've all, or most of us, as consumers, have been too slow to get what's really going on here? Just this process, a bit like a gold rush the turning of the Wild West in the US. It's happened so quickly that we fell for the myth of,
I think, there's
these wonderful free companies which happen to also be the most profitable companies in the world.
Yeah, I think there's several reasons why they've emerged. I mean, one is, I think digital companies tend towards monopolies quicker than analog companies. They can scale up very quickly. I mean, think about the speed with which Airbnb can grow. A traditional company like Hilton has to put all this heavy investment into building new hotel blocks. It's slow and it's difficult, it takes months, it takes years. Airbnb can scale up as quickly as it can build servers, which is infinitely quickly, because it's just other people joining onto the site. And it's the same, they all benefit in the same way from that network effect. And it's good for consumers in a sense, because, you know, when I used to go and buy music, I went to my local store with limited choice. I bought lots of rubbish records, or what was I doing? Where was I? I suppose I was CDs or mini discs. Yeah. But anyway, that's a different point.
That's vinyl and tapes.
Tapes as well, yeah. And so there was a kind of local market of local competition. And now, why would you do that when you can just always download the best stuff from one platform? So you just use that. And the more that it's convenient for us, the more we will go on there, which means the more data they get, which means they can provide an even more efficient service, which means the more users they get. So it scales up very quickly, which is why you get these multi-billion dollar startups that seem to pop up overnight, because they can grow at that speed. There has also been, I think, a sort of a cultural belief that Silicon Valley companies are different. They're cool, they're the bosses are in their 20s and 30s and they turn up to work in a t-shirt, so, you know, how could they be bad? Because what bad guy would ever wear a t-shirt to the office? Which I think is actually starting to hurt them, because it begins to look hypocritical when your motto is do no evil, and you're behaving as Google has in the past. Mm-hmm. So there is a speed element and a tendency towards monopolies of digital companies. But I think it's also it's the cultural bit as well. We just haven't held them to the same standards as other companies. But I mean, now Google is the single biggest spender in terms of lobbying money in Washington, one of the biggest in Brussels and London. And so I think we're beginning to realise, well, wait a minute, they are behaving just like other companies.
So how do we then, if this needs to be done, how do we then cut them down to size, as it were? That was the question we posed on the invitation this evening. Should they be cut down to size? I'm very much of the view that they should be, but what is the best mechanism for doing it?
Yeah, it's a really difficult one. Because the thing is, people talk very breezily about cutting Google in two or something without realising that Google would be far less efficient as a search engine if it was half the size. the bigger it is, the better it is as a search engine, so the better it is for all of us. There'll be significant economic cost of Google being cut down to size, which I think one reason why politicians are loath to do it. How you could possibly nationalise or break up these monopolies when they're not based in this country, they're international, so one of the problems is that the modern monopoly, the modern digital monopoly is very hard to define. A lot of our monopoly law is based, or antitrust law, is based on the problem starts when consumer welfare is hurt, when prices start to go up, or when quality of product starts to go down. I mean, with the modern digital monopolies, prices are so low, or things are free, and the quality of the service is usually amazingly good. So we don't have the same obvious way of judging the harms of a monopoly today. And that's part of the problem. So one of the things that people say is, well, we need more aggressive antitrust measures. So, and it can't be based on consumer welfare. It has to be based on something else. It could be about the proportion of, you know, the proportion of the amount of data that you hold on people.
Yeah.
So on that kind of measure, the European Commission might have, or the US government might have stopped Facebook from buying WhatsApp or Instagram. That's one thing that people, it's easy in retrospect to say that. But I think they're going to be a lot harder in letting these companies buy more other companies. Because one of the problems is that they just keep buying up small upstarts that are challenging them. So one thing is not necessarily to cut them down to size, but to stop them buying up everybody else. So that's going to be one thing. I think the other thing is going to be governments are going to have to find clever ways of holding them to account. I'm usually in favour of any kind of government regulation. I'm not really a pro-government person, but I increasingly look to government to sort these problems out because I'm almost at a loss. So I want governments, when the government says, you know, in Germany, extra fines for social media platforms if they do not remove hate speech within a certain amount of time. I actually disagree with a lot of the hate speech. I think it's far too sort of overbearing. But the idea that the government then comes in and says, if you don't remove that within 24 hours, we're going to fine you €1 million, I'm then all behind it. Because it's just showing who's the boss and that the governments can force their will on these platforms.
But this is the thing that they've been forced to concede, really, in the light of the most recent scandal and Zuckerberg in front of Congress, surely, that they are being dragged, kicking and screaming, to the realisation or the acceptance that they are a publisher. Because, I mean, very often, ultra-free market friends of mine at the IEA, for example, would say, well, come on, you're just an old hack who's just trying to protect traditional journalism from these new insurgents who've revolutionised the media. There's a bit of that. But but it's not just purely that. I mean, it's the sense that they're not playing on a level playing field.
Well, yeah.
I mean, really, just if they had the same restrictions as traditional publishers have, the world would look quite different. And
they wouldn't exist.
It's not that long ago that is how the world worked. Mike Bloomberg put it brilliantly when he said he was asked about this in relation to Bloomberg and the structure of his business and Facebook, and he said, I think Facebook should read everything and sign off on it legally before they publish it, to which Facebook and tech people said, that's insane, you could never do that. Who does that? To which he said, well, we do. And every mainstream media company in the world does that. And that's the idea that was established after the chaos of the invention of the printing press, long period where it took a while for what became libel law and defamation to catch up.
Yeah.
And then eventually the idea became established that if you want to publish something in the public sphere, if you want to put it out there, you are legally responsible for it.
It's, yes. Right. So, but just before I get to that, the other thing, of course, is what mentioning about breaking up the monopolies is our choices as well. Our choices about who we use and what we share and which platforms. We can bring down the monopolies by not using them as much. So that's just another thing. But on this publishing thing, it's become... If social media, I mean, this has been established since they were, I mean, the CDA that was passed in the mid-90s was the thing that set the precedent for the fact that you're in the EU, you're a mere conduit. In the US, you're a platform, not a publisher, so you're not responsible for content unless you're alerted to it, at which point you then have to take reasonable measures to remove it, and then you are going to be held accountable. And I think there's some things that you could do to make them more responsive to complaints. I mean, one of the things, like, it takes you weeks to, or days, or a very long time when people make a complaint about content for it to be removed. And I think there's probably more you can do on that front. But it is true that if they were responsible for every piece of content that were put on their site, they would collapse immediately. And they couldn't do it. I mean, it's billions of pieces of content every day are put up. So, just be aware of what you'd be calling for there. You'd essentially be calling for the immediate destruction of all the social media platforms. And I think that's a slightly too high a price to pay.
As someone addicted to Twitter, I think that sounds rather good.
But Michael Lewis's thing about this is slightly different, and I think slightly more interesting, which is, if you're running adverts against content, the core of your business model, and you are charging people to view those adverts, you're also legally responsible for what's put up there. You can, because people think about Google and Facebook as being tech platforms, whereas really you should see them as advertising companies. And so if that's their core business model, they have to be legally responsible for what's put up as ads. And what Michael Lewis is saying is,
Mr. Money Saving Expert, who is taking Facebook to court for fake adverts using his name, which they've allowed to be published on the site.
Yeah, and his face as well. Yes. And he says that there's no companies that I've allowed to use me. So anytime you can use facial recognition technology to immediately identify any adverts that use a picture of me, I'm telling you now, that's illegitimate. You don't have my permission to do that. So you could take it down before it's even put up, or you could block it before it's put up. And I think that's perfectly sensible. I think it's quite a good place to start, that they take more responsibility for this idea that the ads especially are things that they must check before they are run. And even that would be quite a big change. Because you saw last year maybe that Google's in trouble for running ads against terror content, and there were other ads that were put, and the whole thing just feels like it's far too unregulated. So I think that's a good first step. But
now we're going to take some questions in a minute. So have some questions, but surely it's going to come down to some form of compromise, isn't it? There's not going to be some great global accord which settles this. Certainly not with China having an entirely different model, where they seem to manage to censor the internet perfectly successfully. There are going to be different battles in different jurisdictions, aren't there? There's going to be the US,
yes,
which is significant. There's going to be London post Brexit, and there's going to be the EU, which is very aggressive on tax and a whole host of other stuff.
Yeah.
Do you see it evolving into some form of international cooperation?
No,
or
not really.
Rival jurisdictions.
I mean, Facebook and Google are both sort of suggesting that they might adopt I'm not sure about Google actually, but Facebook, that they might adopt a global version of the GDPR in some way to make it easier for them. Their international headquarters are Dublin, so actually a lot of Facebook users are kind of actually sit within the jurisdiction of the EU anyway. So there may be a way that they start to try to, the big tech companies try to, possibly use the EU law as a kind of, as a decent basis. But I mean, Zuckerberg was a bit vague on this point about whether or not he'd apply the GDPR to the US. We'll see how much political will there actually is.
I loved Sandberg, Facebook, saying that Facebook was perfectly open to the idea of regulation, as though that's how it works. As though sort of the provider says, come on, we're fine with some regulation. It's not really how legislation tends to play out.
And this is the thing that one of the things that worries me. Where we are at the moment, we're already nervous about these things, but you've got to think about the direction of travel. I mean, more and more data is being produced almost exponentially. The algorithms always get faster and cheaper and better. Computing power always gets cheaper.
Yeah.
They're going to get better at various types of data analysis. Of course they are. I just fear that at one point maybe we'll rely on them so much that we'll begin to look to these companies to solve our serious and growing problem of cybercrime. We'll say, oh, governments can't do this anymore. Google, can you maybe sort it out for us? Like, how are we going to stop being hacked by the Russians? Google, you know what to do, don't you? Because you have all the best engineers. And that's one of the great worries about the growth of these monopolies. It's when they start taking... I mean, who's building the future? Who's building the driverless car network, the Internet of Things network? Who's building this? It's not governments. It's private tech companies. So we've got to... I think we've really got to think about where we're heading. And this is what really worries me. Not so much where we are. And I wrote the book as a kind of warning about carrying on the same path and where it takes us.
As you describe it there, I'm just thinking, what could possibly go wrong?